Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast celebrating a very special anniversary this time. Yes, it's been 30 years of Phantasm 2. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir.
I'm looking at our notes and realizing I may have just made a terrible, terrible mistake. How do you feel like winging this one on your own, Andrew?
What's the issue?
It seems it was a completely different movie. I may have misheard you last week in terms of where we were going. It seems, no, we're talking about something called Superman the Movie from 1978.
Oh, I see. You know what? We don't even have to stop the recording. I'm just going to jump out the window, run around my apartment block really, really fast, and that should rewind everything back to normal. Hi, glorious. I'm Andrew Carnegie, sir.
And I'm Dave Babbitt. We're talking about Richard Donner's 1978 film, Superman the Movie, this week. And as you all know, this is a show in which each film we discuss has to somehow connect back to the film the previous week. So, Andrew, this was your pick this week. So, how did we get from the return of Swamp Thing to this?
I know that we kept misspeaking in the previous episode, but I really, really think that there's something endearing about a film called Return to Swamp Thing. That would be like the post-divorce film. So we're following Sarah Douglas, who appeared as Dr. Stereotype in Return of Swamp Thing, who plays Ursa in this film. But we also get a bonus point, because Trevor Howard, who previously was in The Third Man, also appears in Superman.
Yes. See, folks, it eventually all comes together in a nice, rich tapestry.
Thank you for playing. Lovely blue, color-tinted outfit. Where to begin? I think it's safe to say, David, that anyone who has any awareness of superheroes is aware of who Superman is, right? He's the Hulk Hogan of superheroes.
Well, that's just it. I mean, he is the one, the only, the original, originally appearing in 1938 for the first time in Action Comics number one, the creation of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.
Canada's own, or at least exactly. Half of Canada's own. I can't ever remember.
Yeah, half of it belongs to us. But yeah, he is a sort of iconic piece of American literature, the American canon, as it were, culture in general, and has pretty much, over the last 80 years, pretty much been, a fixture in our culture, in culture at large, from comics to radio shows to animation to television series, film serials, multiple film adaptations, and weird film deconstructions that are apparently part of an ongoing massive franchise. I would think it's safe to say, Andrew, Superman is one we all know. But here's my question to you. Oh, sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, there are recognizable heroes, but Superman is in that league of his own. He is truly iconic, not just within comics, but as you said, within American culture, within a North American cultural production sense, Superman is firmly planted within that, which is odd because, as you said, Superman in ancillary media has been around since like the 1940s, when you made me watch that awful Mole Man short. So it's weird because there's so much of Superman that people aren't aware of, and yet, despite the enduring popularity of the character almost from the outset, it's not until 1978 that we finally get, like, the quote-unquote proper film treatment of him.
Yeah, and I guess, it's going to be interesting when placing this film in that context, because I'm not to jump ahead into the debate, because it almost becomes a question of, could this film have existed without that sort of, groundwork being laid over the preceding 40 years leading up to it? In terms of both the design and the sort of reception of the film. But I guess to sort of, bring it on a more personal level to start with, Andrew, obviously we've said everybody kind of knows him, but what are your personal feelings and history with this character?
Well, honestly, Superman is I will freely admit that prior to watching Superman for this episode, I think the last time I would have seen it, I was 8 years old. I've always known who Superman is. I'm firmly on Team DC, no matter how hard they try to make it to love them. And as I got older and became more well-versed in, like, sort of the meta continuity of the DCU, I started gaining more of an appreciation for Superman. As a kid, though, I always thought he was kind of boring. And he falls into the Spectre trap, where when your power set allows you to do anything and be effectively invulnerable in most circumstances, it's really hard to buy into any kind of drama or conflict. Like, there's never a moment as a kid where I would ever worry that Superman was in danger. So I always found myself more drawn to, like, the more relatable comic figures, like a reclusive billionaire genius scientist or a photojournalist who can climb up walls. But, I mean, especially as I get older, like, I also gain a much clearer sense of what Superman means in a cultural sense, and also the aspects that I used to think were kind of hokey or, you know, kind of almost saccharine in a sense. Like, Superman is a wholesome character, and that is the appeal of him. He is, as the film says, he is that light that shows us our best selves, and especially in the 2018 film marketplace, having a superhero that is a clear-cut hero who simply thinks about the best way to use his powers, that is, it's a refreshing change, and it's one I found very welcome.
Well, and this is the thing. I mean, my history is not quite the same as yours, but at least at first, because I, you know, as a kid, you know, I friggin' love Superman. I, you know, the Donner films. And, I mean, particularly, I shouldn't say the Donner films, but the Christopher Reeve series, both from the Donner film right through till Superman 4, you know, were kind of, you know, regular parts of my childhood. They would play often. I remember watching after school, you know, there was the, and I know you're going to groan, Andrew, because you brought it up last week, the Superboy TV series, when that aired.
Well, it gave Lex Luthor an acting credit, so it can't be all bad.
Exactly. And then you get things like, you know, the Lois and Clark TV series, which was kind of a fixture.
And I remember that one probably more closely than I remembered Superman 1978.
Yeah. And understandable. I mean, for me, because, you know, I always was frustrated with that show, mainly because it's like, yeah, you got Superman, you got Lois Lane, but he doesn't really do anything Superman. Like, I mean, there's no supervillains he's really fighting most of the time in that show. And say what you will, at least in the films, you know, as bad as, you know, Quest for Peace may be, he's fighting a nuclear man.
Not so just any man. That,
yeah, so it's got that going for it. But yeah, no, I mean, I really, to me, he was a character I loved as a kid. I tried as best I could in the 90s to sort of follow the comics where I could, which, trust me, DC didn't make easy with having, you know, the storyline flow from, like, over the course of four different titles into each other.
Yeah, because I think you and I and anybody in our generation sort of kind of like that moment where your awareness crystallizes for comic book readers is it 1988 or is it later that they do the Death of Superman arc?
Death of Superman. No, that's really 90s. Yeah, that's like 92 if I'm remembering my dates correctly. 92, maybe 93, but I'm pretty sure it's 92. And yeah, I remember what that was being a big deal. Heck, I remember my grandfather, you know, talking about it like this was kind of a big deal. And trust me, that man didn't read comics at all, so I can assure you of that.
But as a kid reading those books as well, though, it struck me as so odd that DC basically spent the next year, not just in the stories proper, but having all the characters reflect on the absence of Superman. Like, there was that tangible sense that him being, well, comic book dead, which never lasts unless you're Uncle Ben. It's the idea that even within his own fictional story world, people are talking about what he means and what he symbolizes. So as a kid, it's like, well, now that he's gone, I only am starting to understand why he matters so much to so many.
Well, and it's the thing that's kind of interesting, because to jump back to our previous show, 24 Panels, there, we did a run of some of the animated Superman films that were based on the comics. And one thing that's worth noting is, I think for as long as I've been around, certainly, it feels like there's been this ongoing anxiety about, you know, where does Superman fit into the world at large these days? You know, can we make him hip? Can we make him cool? What do we need to do to make him, quote unquote,
can relevant? We make him walk around America?
Yeah, and there's things, you know, and some of those things have been, you know, fairly, you know, goofy, like, hey, let's give him a mullet. And, you know, that'll make him hip with the kids. And stuff like that. And it's just sort of, you know, it's harmless stuff. And then you had things like, again, to sort of come back into the early parts of this decade and sort of through the Zack Snyder films, you know, we had basically almost a complete flip on who Superman is. We had the angry, you know, Superman of the New 52, the one who, you know, has got more of a chip on his shoulder, who's in some ways maybe kind of reflects back to what the early version of Siegel and Schuster's one. And it's kind of noticeable, you know, between that and the utter dourness of the Snyder films that we've received so far, that there seems to be really this embracing, like, of the idea of, no, we don't want, you know, a Superman that isn't idyllic at this point. And, you know, this idea that, you know, there's something we want to, you know, preserve about that, and recognizing this has a place in our culture, particularly as things seem to go increasingly to hell in a handbasket around us, it seems. Those weird little iconic fixtures, you know, become increasingly important, as it were. And I'm sure if you spend any time on social media, folks, you've seen any number of classic sort of 40s and 50s era PSA art of Superman talking about what it means to be American going along online. And it's like about, you know, welcoming refugees into the country, accepting the difference of others, tolerance, those sorts of things, you know, that we sort of really come to identify.
Well, there's also him punching out Japanese soldiers and encouraging people to buy U.S. war bonds.
I'm not saying it isn't a history without problems.
He's a Superman for all seasons.
Yeah, let's, yes, not an unproblematic history, but I certainly, in terms of what people want him to be, and what the character can be at his best, is certainly something that I feel many people are really responding to, and sort of defending, as it were, today. And it's very notable that one of the, again, for comics nerds, like myself, one of the big things they finally did was undo that sort of New 52 thing and restore Superman not only as an idyllic figure, but as a prominent family man. This is a man who's now a father, who's trying to teach his son right from wrong and guide him through tough choices in the world, which feels so right. And is kind of shocking that that's only really been something that we've seen over the past 2 years. Really coming.
Well, yeah, because I think especially, I mean, audiences that aren't well-versed in comics history, I'd say that most people in the world have probably seen Man of Steel and, against Doctor's Orders, Dawn of Justice. And that really feels like, I almost feel like our cultural awareness of Superman got reevaluated around the same time of Kill Bill Volume 2, because David Carradine has his lengthy little monologue about why Superman is a fundamentally different superhero than everybody else. And his reason is that he's an alien masquerading as a weak, fallible human being. That his superhero self, that's his true form, and Clark Kent is the persona. And I feel like Snyder's films almost tried to hammer that home too much. And the result is we have Superman that's this detached god figure that has very few redeeming qualities about him. So it's nice to see the pendulum swing back and be like, well, there was a reason that people liked Superman in the first place, and it wasn't because he could destroy everybody just as soon as blink.
Well, yeah, and I think to bring it back to this film, and to the Richard Donner's 1978 film, I think it's very interesting how this film has really come to dominate that discourse surrounding the Man of Steel, because, again, there are many interpretations of Superman, and, you know, many other iconic superheroes. I mean, most notably, probably Batman is, you know, his closest rival in those terms. And yet, the thing about it is, you know, while people have their favorite Batman, Even the most hardened fan of Superman, even the defenders of your Henry Cavills, your Brandon Routh, your Dean Cains, almost everybody universally agrees that there is something about Christopher Reeve and that first film in particular that embodies that character in a way that, you know, for whatever else you may say about it, it seems almost, you know, to crystallize what that perfect image of Superman
is. Well, yeah, and in the making of this film, apparently they delayed production for a good long time because the producing duo of the Salkinds, when they finally wanted to get the project rolling, the biggest consideration was who is going to play Superman. Because older audiences would have remembered George Reeves from the earlier versions, yeah. But in terms of who's going to be our generation's cinematic Superman, they ended up going with Christopher Reeve, but it was a long process. But I've got to say, it is a process that seems entirely worthwhile because, I mean, we may as well just jump right in, but Christopher Reeve... Yeah. The way he plays Clark Kent, the way he plays Superman, like, even for a film that wasn't a big part of my childhood, there's something that just feels right about it.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And it's one of those things where the inherent decency that he just extrudes on screen is, it's palpable. I mean, it's not, it's one of those few times you can feel... Yeah, I buy that this person is everything they say about him, as it were. And that's not an easy feat to fit. Not to mention, again, classically, he looks like Superman. He has the right kind of build where he's not, you know, the, you know, muscle-bound Superman of the 90s comics, but he is that, you know, this dude's fit. He looks like he could handle himself in a fight. He's got that perfect sort of square jaw, but it's sort of offset by those, you know, beautiful eyes he has that, you know, I'm trying to think about how to put it.
It's like, he's physical without being threatening, and he's charming without being aloof. Like, Christopher Reeve plays the role in such a way that he can go through all the different notes that the character needs to hit in the course of the film, and all of it feels completely organic.
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. And, I mean, if this film did not have him, I have a hard time imagining it working even a fraction as good as it does.
Yeah, it's like, I find it hard to think that, like, Dennis Quaid as Superman would have had the same results. But going by the production of this film, though, I think it's worth noting that 1978 feels like a lifetime ago, especially because neither you nor I had been born yet. And it's easy to overlook the fact that when we think about, like, blockbusters and big-budget films of the era, we tend to think of them almost as, like, quaint in a sense, where it's like, oh, well, it was pretty good for 1978. But, like, from the outset, this film was positioned and intended to be an all-star film. Like, this was intended to be the epic film that fans have been clamoring for. When it was made in 1978, it had set the record, actually, for most expensive production, which ended up being totally okay, because I think its worldwide gross was over $300 million, which, adjusted for inflation, is pretty mind-boggling. It's on par with what films are taking in today in a very different market. But also, when you go through the cast, not just the actors, but the production crew as well, like, this is a film that screams A-list. And that's probably why the opening credits themselves are about 4 minutes long. We have Richard Donner directing it, who, I'll freely admit, I'm not a Donner-phile. Dave, do you know off the top of your head what was notable in his filmography prior to this?
Well, along with having, you know, worked extensively in television, including doing episodes of The Twilight Zone, amongst other things, the film that got him this job in particular was The Omen.
Ah, yes.
Which it ended up being a huge smash hit, because, if I'm not mistaken, I want to say it was... Was it Guy Hamilton or George Hamilton? Yeah, Guy Hamilton, I think, who was originally approached about doing this, and he couldn't return to the UK where they filmed the bulk of this due to issues with the tax man, we should say.
Oh, what, did a mysterious fog ground his plane at Heathrow?
I can't not confirm nor deny that, but...
So it's probably true.
Yeah, but, you know, Donner comes on board, and by the time he had arrived, you know, there had been already a number of people to have taken a crack at doing the screenplay. I mean, Mario Puzo, yes, that Mario Puzo of The Godfather.
Which blew my mind when I saw it in the credits.
Yeah, he did a draft, then David and Leslie Newman took a crack at it, and then Robert Benton, and none of those scripts... apparently the end result of that development process by the time Donner got there was something that was a very campy, almost Batman the 1960s series.
Which I find so hard to believe, because it's like, okay, well, we have the guy who made The Godfather and the guy who wrote Chinatown, and they made this movie way too goofy. I don't see how that's possible. But there it is.
Yeah, no, it was. And again, I think that speaks to sort of the notion of the attitude that people had towards comic books and superheroes by this point in time, which was as this sort of campy, you know, fodder that can't necessarily be taken seriously. Which Donner comes on board, brings writer Tom Mankiewicz, who had worked on numerous Bond films with him, to rewrite the screenplay from scratch. Now, Mankiewicz doesn't end up with a screenplay credit, thanks to, I guess, some issues with the Writers Guild, but he did end up getting a creative consultant.
Oh, yes, that wonderful catch-all.
Yeah, which, you know, but by all accounts, he is really the real screenwriter on this film. And when it comes down to it, Donner's whole approach was to, you know, take the material appropriately seriously. I don't, and when we say that, I don't mean he was taking a Christopher Nolan-esque, you know, does this work in reality? Can this actually happen?
Yeah, seriousness is not the same as verisimilitude, you know, how closely a film can approximate our reality. And nor does a serious film have to have, like, dark themes and be institutionally paranoid or only focus on, like, the more cynical aspects of human nature. And I think that's a mistake that contemporary superhero films often make. The idea that if we want this to be a serious movie, everything has to be shot through a blue filter and 90% of the footage is characters hand-wringing.
Yeah, and that is definitely not this film. But yeah, so Donner steps in and that's his general approach. Now, certain casting choices had been made by the time he got there. So, for example, the funding for this film was dependent upon Marlon Brando and Gene Hackman being in the film. So they were already in place by the time Donner got there. But pretty much everybody else from that point on ends up being somebody Donner selects. John Barry works on the production design. And again, for Bond fans, this is one of the legendary artists who helped define the look of the early Bond films. Jeffrey Unsworth is the cinematographer. This is towards the end of his life. And damn, I'll break my cursing rule there for a second, but this film looks like $1 million under his light.
Yeah, it is a gorgeous film. And that's, I watched the 2000 extended cut on DVD, but like it pops off the screen. Like we've talked about other films being painterly, but this is one of the few films I would say looking at is majestic. Because even the scenes in Metropolis, the ones that are supposed to be, like, closest to our reality, the film doesn't set itself in 1978, though. It sets itself in that weird, like, sort of 1950s retro-futurist style that I think certainly Tim Burton's Batman, and to a lesser extent Joel Schumacher's Batman, are more, I think, closely aligned with. But that aesthetic is on display here, and it looks terrific.
Yeah, no, this film walks a really fine line, because the film is, structurally speaking, and I know we haven't gotten into the plot or anything, but there are three very distinct units, in each with their sort of own look. There's the first 20 or so minutes, which are set on Krypton, basically how the planet went to hell in a handbasket and Kal-El got sent off of Earth, or off a planet to go towards Earth, which have this very sort of ethereal, you know, there's definitely evocations of, you know, Krypton as heaven, as it were, or some sort of, you know, place of the deities, as it
and
were.
And aesthetically, sort of... these sequences firmly place Superman as a sci-fi movie. I feel like there's definitely, yeah. like, everyone's wearing silver robes, all the structures are crystalline. Like, the sets, they look like a much, much higher budget version of, say, something you would see at the 1950s drive-in. Speculative fiction about the worlds beyond ours.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely envisioning a different world, a different society. Like, Krypton is very evidently not just humans, but with, you know, cooler tech. There's something different about this world. And Donner and Unsworth's cinematography and Barry's design really sell that. It is just a gorgeous piece of cinema to watch. And as I was mentioning to you, Andrew, I ended up having my... infant nephew with me for a little bit of the film in the early going, and he was just, you know, again, he's only like 4 months old, but his attention was in rapture, which is not something that is typically the case for an infant at that stage,
or for adults in this day and age.
Yeah, true. But yeah, no, it plays like gangbusters. And there, I will note that they're in the, because I watched the 3-hour cut that was prepared for television that's now available through Warner Archive for this viewing of the film. And there's even additional shots that sort of emphasize the sort of grandeur of the Krypton and its sci-fi nature, including there's one brief shot still in the special edition version where you see a Kryptonian guard reporting on to some of the elders about energy at Jor-El's place and being told to investigate
yes,
it.
Yes, that shot was in my version.
Yeah. Yeah, that version's in there. There's an additional shots not in your version, though, where it's almost Blade Runner-esque, where you just see, you know, this tight close-up on the visor as this guard is patrolling Krypton and as everything goes to hell. And you're just seeing the city reflected back at him. And it is just gorgeous and weird. And yeah, it really does feel almost like a oddly proto-Blade Runner at that moment. But yeah,
and so I guess maybe to drop it in here, I'm assuming even if people aren't comic book fans, we all know the broad strokes of Superman's origin. And Superman 1978, it stands to reason that this is an origin story. But, I mean, the shorthand version, born on Krypton, Krypton's gonna explode, he gets sent to Earth, the yellow sun makes him much, much stronger and more capable than the average man. And then, as he grows up on Earth, young Kal-El must decide what kind of man he wants to be.
Pretty much, yeah. Which leads us, you know, into the sort of second segment, which is this, you know, basically, having arrived on Earth, we sort of, after a brief introduction where he's found by the Kents, played by Glenn Ford and... Oh, please tell me I wrote down Martha Kent's actor here. I did not. I feel shame.
I was just looking it up. But go ahead and stall for time. I'll clearly not be looking at my phone.
But yeah, anyways, you have, you know, him found by the Kents, and then you sort of jump ahead to Clark as a teenager. Where, if I'm not mistaken, he's played by, I think, Jeff East at this point.
I believe you're right on that one.
Yeah, with a little bit of makeup on his face, and I think Christopher Reeve dubs the voice in at this point as well, which, again... second week in a row, we can give some credit to some really good dubbing in the on this or being done in these.
Yeah, films. I honestly thought that it was Christopher Reeve young down for that sequence. So that's a pleasant surprise.
But yeah, so basically, you have this at this point, this very Norman Rockwell-esque design and this sort of flash, you know, retro aesthetic to what 1950s America is like, and or at least the popular image of it. And it is, again, simply gorgeous. And the way that there's this real almost like, I don't want to say film because that's not what it is, but there's this very, you know, sort of nostalgic, almost like it's not quite a cloud around the screen, but there is that sort of very soft filtered light.
Yeah, like a kind
makes
of
everything a little bit
a dreaminess about it, especially in contrast to like sort of the cold sterility of Krypton. And the fact that Jor-El, played by Brando, as the father of Superman, like, he has enormous dilemmas on his mind. Because he discovers the planet is likely going to be consumed by the sun. He's forbidden from speaking about it by the council. He's facing these life or death issues. And then he makes the sacrifice of sending Cal to Earth. Whereas in Smallville, Kansas, we have the Kent family, including Phyllis Thaxter as Martha.
Thank you.
But, yes. I mean, they are just, they're an elderly rural couple who, you know, it stands to reason, like, we have a diametrically opposite parental unit, a diametrically opposite space, and a diametrically opposite set of, I guess, philosophical concerns amongst the characters. So it stands to reason that these sequences should also be visually distinct from one another. And they are, and it's not just, like, one's the opposite of the other, but they cultivate a very different sensibility in their own way.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you could say that they are almost individual segments and in divisions there, but they flow so well from one into the other. Like, it's not feeling, they don't feel desperate. They don't feel like they are, you know, at odds with each other in a way that doesn't benefit the film itself.
Yeah, and as we were talking about earlier, like, the version that I watch is just over 2.5 hours long, and especially, like, for modern audiences, like, that I think most people would consider a long movie. But it doesn't really feel like it. And I think because all the ground that it covers moves so fluidly and scenes connect to one another so organically, there's no dead time. Like, that's not to say that every sequence is action-packed or follows the serial structure of Star Wars or Indiana Jones and classical adventure, but this is a film that never loses focus, and it's simply, like, really, it's a filmic building's roman, in a sense, where we're watching the development of a life from youth to adulthood, and, you know, the changes that come along the way. Filmically, from the beginning to the end of the film, we're watching, like, a similar development in a certain way.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely not wrong here. And it's, again, it's very telling, that part and parcel of, again, modern audiences will probably see it a mile coming now, but, again, this is a sequence that climax with, you know, the death of Pa Kent and Clark's inability to save him, which, again, compared to the absurdity of how it's handled in Man of Steel.
Dive in the archives to find out what Dave thinks about Pa Kent.
I'm afraid that they can't. Sadly, all those episodes are now offline. But, yeah, needless to say, I'm not big on Kevin Costner's, you know, nihilistic Pa Kent and his, you know, seeming disbelief in the possibility of a decent decency anywhere. Despite what, you know, they retroactively try to force on us in, you know, Dawn of Justice, but still contradict it with Ghost Pa Kent's tale of, you know, I thought I saved the day and then I just made somebody else's life miserable.
Well,
good work, Pa Kent.
There's a very different emphasis across the two films in how it treats the death of Jonathan Kent, because in Man of Steel, that moment is used as sort of like to promote a, like, a negative philosophical crisis in the way that, you know, Pa basically forbids Clark from doing anything to rescue him because he needs to keep Clark's powers secret. And, you know, on paper, we're supposed to see it as the heroic sacrifice. His son can have a normal life, even at the cost of his own. Whereas in this film, like, it's much more organic. It's matter of fact. It's, well, your dad was an old man and he died of a heart attack. But that prompts Clark's realization in this film. What's the line he says? All of these powers and I couldn't do anything to save him. Like, that prompts a much more interesting philosophical question. And that's the question that Clark carries throughout the rest of the film, which is, yes, he has all these amazing gifts. Yes, he's told through hologram Jor-El about all the things he can do and all the different influences he can have on human civilization. But the real question is, well, to what end? How can I put this to use? And what is the value of being able to do this if I can't protect or save the people closest to me? And the rest of the film that follows really feels more like a morality play than anything, because the overriding theme is, what do you do when you can do anything?
Well, absolutely, and it's notable that the film is based, the way in which it's structured is the repeated losses to Clark Kent, which is, you know, first the destruction of his home, then the loss of Pa Kent, and then ultimately, spoilers folks, the death of Lois Lane being the ultimate sort of turning point towards the end of this film, and how he chooses to handle that. And yeah, no, it's very much about this notion of, you know, choosing to be a decent individual over anything else he could theoretically be, and learning lessons like, yeah, I could really, like, there's that great scene between Clark and Pa Kent, the right before Pa bites the bucket.
Bites the bucket? Where, you know, what an awful way to go.
Kicks the bucket. Yeah, sorry, folks. But where, you know, he has that conversation about, you know, Clark saying, you know, is it wrong, you know, to, you know, if I'm good at something, to do it. And Pa Kent's basically having to sort of very carefully navigate. It's like, you know, there's nothing wrong with the fact that you can do it. It's just, you know, is that the best use of what you could be doing right now?
Yeah, you could be a star football player and outrun trains, and yeah, it's fun, but is that what you're meant to do?
Yeah. And again, there is a simplicity to this film, because it's very direct in its address. Like, it doesn't, this is not a film dealing with shades of nuance in the way of, again, as the Snyder films attempt and mostly fail to do. But this is a film that, you know, it's not didactic, but it is very simple in its sort of emotional register. It's very direct in how it wants to, about the issues it wants to discuss, and it is very clean and easy to follow in that manner. And credit where credit's due to Mankiewicz and Donner for keeping that in place. Because on one hand, not only does it allow the film, you know, to, again, sort of in the sort of classic Hollywood angle of, you know, it can play for the people in Peoria, as it were. But we have, you know, it works in the sense that it's a film that ends up really functioning as a family movie in a way that most films don't. Because this is a film that I think, you know, very young children can watch and easily understand in a way. And that's not to say that it's a simplistic movie, just that it's a film that meets them on their terms in terms of what they're ready to handle.
And yeah, you don't have to explain schools of philosophy or geopolitics or whether or not scenes are allusions to other historical trauma or anything like that. It's, you know, yeah, as you said, it's not a didactic film, but it seems like a very forthright film. That there's one central question that the film grapples with, and the two positions one can take on the question are clear from the outset.
No, absolutely. And it's also a remarkably, you know, in a way, it is a film that really struck me this time out is kind of rather progressive in terms of things such as the masculinity it wants to put forward in this film, in the sense that what is Superman in this place? He's not a punch people, ask questions later type individual, or someone who, you know, is disrespectful. I mean, this is somebody who's open and honest, and his basic approach to all things is treat people decently throughout this film. And there, you know, you sit there and you expect that there's going to be something deeply problematic, or, you know, that might crop up in one of these older films. And credit where credit's due to this film, that doesn't happen here. This is not a case where, you know, again, even watching episodes of the old George Reeves show, which, again, I have nothing but admiration for, but you can tell when you watch it, there's some very 1950s, you know, male chauvinism that occasionally pops up in that episode, which makes it occasionally a bit cringeworthy in terms of, is this okay to show a kid or not these days? Selective editing, folks. Make sure to screen stuff before you show it to
kids. Always good advice. But during this viewing, though, in the back of my mind, I was thinking about what friend of the show, Dr. Drew Jeffries, mentioned, where when the Salkinds were making their subsequent project to this, they decided to do a film about Santa Claus. And the idea that the interest in making a Superman film is not because of his stature in comics, but his stature as a symbol of something to American audiences. And, you know, anyone who's listened to previous episodes knows that I'm the guy most likely to start yelling about politics. And I think in 1978, you have a post-Civil Rights America, you have post-Vietnam America, you have post-Watergate America, you have post-many things America. So to suddenly make a film that foregrounds like the 1950s aesthetic and sort of calling on these American tropes and the idea of like the American way itself, part of me was very worried that that would be deeply problematic, calling back to a sort of a historical imaginary that never really existed. And, you know, all the trappings of masculinity and society that come with it. And it's weird because this film is nostalgic, but, and I mean, there are issues that it elides, but this film isn't interested in that, but it doesn't come off as tone deaf. It doesn't come off as misguided, because I think, again, the earnestness of Reeves' performance in this movie, like, there's the part where Lois asks him, like, what are you about? And he says, I stand for truth, justice, and the American way. And, like, she scoffs, like, you don't really believe that, do you? Well, he does, and that's the thing. You know, we look at a text like this now and sort of think, well, the idea of, oh, well, your whole MO is that you just always do the right thing. Clearly, there has to be more to it than that. And to which Reeves would probably respond with, well, why does there need to be? It can be that simple. Just, you know, again, he is sent down to Earth as that light that can show us what we all can be if we're just decent to one another.
Well, and that's it. I mean, this film, it's nostalgic, but it's not, you know, it's not oblivious to what is going on in the world around it, because you get to things such as, I mean, once you enter into the sort of third segment of the film, the one that takes the majority of it, which is the Metropolis sequences where Superman finally arrives on this scene and ends up having to face off with Lex Luthor, Otis, and Miss Tessmacher in the scheme to, you know, sink the West Coast into the ocean so Lex can pull off a property scheme. The thing about it is, you know, they don't pretend that crime in that doesn't exist in this movie. You have Lois Lane, you know, who's reporting on, you know, basically rapists in this
film. Yeah, rapists, corrupt politicians, arms deals. Like, these things are all, they're within the diegesis. Like, it's not, you know, that Superman's biggest crisis is how to get a cat out of a tree. Though he does still do that.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing about it is this isn't a film that presents, it's nostalgic without sitting there saying everything's ideal. And again, it's part and parcel of that I think also stems from the fact that part of, again, the sequences with Jor-El are kind of about, you know, it's like, this is where humanity can go. This is, you know, it's about looking, it's nostalgic, but it's also looking to the future about how, okay, we can make things better this way. We can change things here. This is how you can help people to do the right thing.
Yeah, because again, the whole idea of nostalgia is inherently a conservative position to take. And it lends itself to the golden age fallacy of, oh, well, do you remember the 1960s, that was a much simpler time, and we didn't have any of these problems. And you'll see elected officials make those same arguments of, well, remember the 1950s when, you know, people just knew how to act and certain people knew they weren't welcome at golf courses? We need to live like that. Whereas this film, its nostalgia is to evoke that quote-unquote simpler time, but it's less problematic because it's saying, really, the part that we should be focused on is when there was this sense of community and the sense of a nation and the sense of individuals just wanting to be good to one another. And again, that may sound naive, that may sound idealistic, that may sound oversimplified, and it is, but the way that the film presents it, it's hard to find fault with what it's doing.
Yeah, no, I mean, the film is not, you know, and I would imagine if, you know, Donner went on the record about it, I mean, he would admit that, you know, the film isn't, you know, prescriptive necessarily about what needs to be done, per se, to improve things. But again, it's just about, that simple notion about what can we do and what is the sort of fundamental basis for every decision we make going forward, which is, again, as we've repeatedly said here, be decent, treat people with decency and respect, and, you know, try and do the right thing for the most people where you can. And again, I mean, it's does it in its own very pop way, but it's earnest, it's affecting. And yeah, I mean, I'm not gonna lie, there is the moment during the Lois Clark interview on her balcony where she asks, who is he, and he just says, you know, a friend. Yeah. And I'm sorry, I got teary at that. And that's, you know, probably, you know, something kind of odd to get teary at, but it works. And I love that thing, that there is, yeah, something innately just that decent about this individual and about how things could be. You know, if anybody was actually putting effort into trying to do that.
Well, yeah. And, like, I guess not to keep reflecting everything off of Man of Steel, but that's a film where Superman is a Superman in the sense that he is the accelerated version of everything humans are in terms of what we can do, in terms of, like, how our bodies can operate. He is just physically beyond anything that humans are capable of. Whereas in this film, he's Superman in the sense that he is the best aspects of natural human tendencies. He is the best face to put forward. And yeah, like, he doesn't announce himself, I'm Superman, I come from Krypton, worship me, mortals. It's just, I'm a friend. And then he just jumps, flies away, because there's somebody else that needs his help. And then he just does that little wave of, see ya. And, like, yeah, I mean, I think in comics readers know, like, the classic Superman idea is him winking towards the audience in the last panel and just saying something kind of corny, but that is the charm of it. And, you know, in terms of that, like, by the time this film was made, we didn't know who Zack Snyder was. His parents probably didn't either. But, you know, in terms of capturing, like, Superman in comics from the outset up until, like, the Silver Age, like, this film is the perfect distillation of all of those traits.
Well, no, absolutely. And it's a thing. It's not a... And I think where a lot of people tend to get hung up on, and I'll admit, growing up, one of the things that, you know, tended to get, I myself would get hung up on as I got older, and you would have, I think inevitably everybody goes to that, the, oh geez, that's a little bit corny, or, you know, that doesn't make a lot of sense, is the notion of both its faithfulness, quote unquote, to the source material, and some of the elements that might be considered, you know, illogical or goofy, such as the fact that, yeah, one of the most notorious elements of this film, well, twofold, there are two notorious elements. One is the idea of the villains of this film, the previously mentioned Lex Luthor, Miss Tessmacher, and Otis, as being sort of joke characters in a way, and ultimately the way in which Superman saves the day, which is this rotating the Earth backwards in order to travel in time and prevent Lois's death. And yeah, it's one of those things where I think everybody's gone, it's been, you know, gone over time and again about how these things are problems. And yet I find myself, maybe I'm just getting to be an old man at this point, but they really don't bother me, particularly during this viewing. And in fact, I almost feel that this film earns them.
Yeah.
In a way.
I think it's because compared to, like, the quote unquote verisimilitude of today, like, it's like when they did these Star Wars prequels, and then they had to come up with a scientific explanation of what the Force is, and the idea that in order to make things plausible and have audiences believe it, we need to use pseudoscience and all this mumbo-jumbo about why things can be a certain way they are. And, like, Whereas in this film, it operates in that magic realist territory where the world is unified, and yes, things happen that can't happen in reality, but it's firmly within its own rules that it sets out for itself. And I guess, you know, for me, it's like, this film is not trying to ground everything in reality. Like, it's not explaining exactly how Earth's yellow sun influences his Kryptonian DNA. You know, so it's not the deal breaker that, you know, I certainly remembered it to be, and certainly, like, snarky pop culture blogs often talk about it as. Because, again, like, the film is not interested necessarily in, well, how come he can do all these things? It's just, he can do all these things, so what's he going to do with them?
Well, and that's it. I mean, the film really operates on mythic fantasy, because as we've sort of noted throughout here, I mean, so much of the production design and the dialogue, and that really underscores the notion of Superman as a mythic figure, or as a fantasy figure. I mean, there's nods to the idea of, you know, being like Peter Pan because he can fly.
And not just a mythic figure, but a biblical figure as well.
Well, yeah, and then there's the, despite the fact that Superman was created by two members of the Jewish community, Donner very much underscores the idea of Superman as Christ figure here, with, you know, lines such as, this is why I sent them you, my son. Here, and this, like, you know, Jor-El, again, appearing as this floating head god figure. And again, the sort of idea of Krypton as science heaven.
And even his monologue about, you know, in his death, he will live on imparting his knowledge onto young Kal-El, and he will continue to live on through the son, just as the son will live on through the memories of the father, and sort of the unity of body between the two. And I mean, it's not heavy-handed. I feel like it is, the way it comes off has to be deliberate. Like, this isn't just like a clever, subversive reading of the film. Like, I think it's overt enough that it's there, but again, you know, it doesn't come off in the sense of, like, boosterism for religion either. It's just, I think it's more operating at that level of, like, mythic archetype, where here is a story that we're all familiar with, we all know the notes of, and everybody, regardless of affiliation, there's at least something immediately understandable about the story this film is telling.
No, absolutely. And I think, again, not to continue harping on Snyder's Man of Steel and the other films, but again, I mean, you look at the way in which he approaches Krypton and the sort of status of what Superman is, and he very much approaches it like a First Contact movie. Superman is an alien. He's shown up on Earth, and now humanity has to deal with, okay, there are other beings on other worlds. What do we do? How do we not lose our mind in the process? And, you know, what does this mean for us going forward? Versus, again, that's not really anything. Like, this is not interested in the major societal shifts that come from dude with a cape shows up. I mean, he gives an interview where he explains his weaknesses and limits of his abilities in a newspaper here. And that becomes a crucial plot point.
And even the way that the other characters in the film respond to him, he's not a threat. He's just a really interesting guy. Nobody is saying, like, well, what if there are others? You know, what does this mean for national security or anything? Instead, there's that golden age, that sort of sensibility in the comics themselves, and certainly in comics readers, of looking towards the future and what could be possible. And the response is, gee, wow, wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, it you know, as the film sort of dovetails into its, you know, climactic, you know, final hour or so of the film, it suddenly is, you know, a case of, you know, Lex doesn't have, you know, his thing is, okay, this guy could possibly bugger up my plans, so I've got to find a way to take him down. And through deductive reasoning that doesn't really hold up if you're approaching it from a logical perspective, decides that, hey, there are radioactive rocks on Earth, maybe they'll hurt him. And that kind of central logic to how it works. But again, the film earns that suspension of disbelief in terms of how it works. I mean, again, to come back to sort of the Lex and Company sequences here, you know, there is something where, again, a lot of people have knocked this for because of the way in which Lex isn't necessarily a threat per se. And again, I was one of them for some time. And again, maybe it is the getting to be an old man sequence, but I don't mind the fact that that's the case so much anymore. In fact, I really have come to love Gene Hackman and Ned Beatty and Valerie Perrin's comedic timing and chemistry in this film, because they just play off of each other so well. And I think there is something kind of interesting in the way in which Donner, you know, sets them up as this sort of bumbling trio to a degree, with Lex as a more refined Mo, as it were, dealing with these individuals. And it's like, okay, they're jokey, they're goofy. And then when the wheel turns in the final act and you realize, oh yeah, his plan is mass murder. And again, it's something that particularly once you watch, it's there in all versions of the film, but I think it really gets underscored in the 3-hour TV cut of it, which is the way, the level of devastation that Lex's plan causes, when it's not just, you know, it's not just that it's going to sink it into the ocean. Even when Superman stops the rocket, you end up dealing with things such as, you know, there's still all these afterquakes and tremors, and he's rushing around trying to save everybody bit by bit, you know, rebuilding the dam, saving Hydra workers from falling cables, the Hollywood sign itself collapsing as people are around it. Like, it's very much this idea of, okay, he's a kind of a joke threat, but, you know, he's only funny up until the point where you suddenly see his plan in action itself.
Well, yeah, but it's up there until that moment, though. Like, okay, it's not that the villains take me out of the film, but I will say that on watching, their scenes are easily the weakest. Like, okay, I love Gene Hackman. I think he does well with what he's given. But I just, the problem is that, and I know it seems like I might be contradicting myself for being like, the film allows you to suspend disbelief, but why is Lex Luthor a villain? Because he announces himself to the audience as the world's greatest criminal mind. We know he's a bad guy because the police are following him. But we're never given a sense of why, or how he has this amazing Park Avenue apartment they talk about that's also accessible by secret subway tunnel. You know, he kills a policeman. I mean, that's certainly not a nice thing to do. But for him to be construed as a threat worthy of Superman, like, he comes off as no more severe than, say, the hoodlum stealing a boat, or for that matter, the guy just randomly using suction cups to climb a skyscraper as one of those throwaway beats. So, which is a shame, because I think Lex Luthor can be, certainly in the right writer's hands and the right performer's hands, it is a complex character, and there are a lot of interesting things you can do with it. It's more, like, I guess I feel like it's okay because the Luthor is a peripheral concern to the film itself. Like, the final climax is not a face-off between Superman and Lex Luthor. The climax is Superman trying to unravel a trap set on him by Luthor. And I think that speaks to the fact that, well, the man is kind of secondary. I will say, though, that Ned Beatty, this film would not be worse off if he was not in it. It's just, again, there's like, I see what it's trying to do with like this bumbling triptych and like this quasi-criminal family. And the three of them do kind of play off each other well, but from the moment he walks into the film wearing like his dumb hat and his theatrical bow tie, and just the moment that it gets really slapsticky, I feel like Otis in this film, like, signals a turning point, and it just becomes a less interesting film. And it also begs the question of, and it's weird because, you know, it begs the question of, if Luthor is this brilliant criminal mastermind, why did he surround himself with two people that clearly are just going to ruin everything? And like, Miss Tessmacher even asks, like, why are you doing this plan when so many people have to die? And I do love his response, because he says, why does the telephone only ring when you're in the bathtub? Why do I, a brilliant man, surround myself with idiots like you two? But he asks that rhetorically and never answers it, and I'm like, I feel like that's a question you might want to answer.
See, the thing about it, there's sort of two sides where I can see where you're coming from on that. At the same time, I think part and parcel of the thing about the way in which this film approaches Luther is he is very much the embodiment of the stock villain characters of these kinds of adventure stories as well. Because I think one of the things of when it comes to Lex Luthor as a threat, this is not to dismiss the character in the comics prior to the 1986 relaunch of DC, post-crisis, for my fellow nerds there, but it's the notion that Lex Luthor is the complex, nuanced, difficult character that we've sort of come to know and love is really an invention of the post-Chris Reeve.
That's true, and that is a fair point to make.
And the thing about it is, yeah, this version of Lex is, you know, he is very much the pop comic villain. Why is he bad? Well, because he wants money. He's greedy. He is, you know, the comedic, you know, again, if the film is investing Superman with this earnestness and this seriousness, you know, Lex is sort of the comedic foil, the worst of humanity, and almost being parodic in the way in which it portrays. Again, it kind of works for me. And I think what also helps here is, and again, it's something that I think works still, even though it was slightly hampered in the execution, was the fact that, again, this was filmed at the same time as Superman 2 was. And there was some reconstruction of what these films would be, both in the post-production on the first one, and then ultimately when filming on Part 2 resumed under a different director, Richard Lester. But the plan had been, in essence, that, you know, the villains were always going to be Zod, Ursa, and Non.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought up the tortured production of this film, and especially why we have all these different competing versions of this one, and then the Donner cut, and the arguments over what's the true version. I think it's just a shame, because the film opens with Zod and co. being sentenced to the Phantom Zone, and It's a shame because they come off as interesting villains. And you know that when they come back, they're going to have a severe vendetta out for everybody. And, like, it sets up that thread really masterfully. Because if a sequel was going to be made, and clearly was by the time they started filming, you have a ready-made villain that's already been introduced. If Superman, the 1978 one, was one and done, well, it still works because it shows that Jor-El also has to grapple with questions of power and responsibility, much like his son does. But the end result is like, oh, you have three really cool-looking villains that you can't wait to see them like dust up and pose a real threat, but you won't see them until next time around. In the meantime, here are the three stooges that are supposed to be an obstacle for the Man of Steel. And you're right where once the plan goes into motion and how he's able to trick Superman into opening the lead box full of kryptonite, like, that's clever. It shows the kind of villain that Lex Luthor could be. But the rest of it, like, the rest of it, he just comes off as so buffoonish that I feel like it just, something doesn't gel for me. And the fact that at the end of the film, like, he brings Luthor in by literally grabbing him and Otis and flying them into a prison yard and telling the warden to lock them up. You know, like, that's his exit from the film. And it's like, that just kind of speaks to how seriously we're supposed to take this character at all.
It does to a degree. I mean, I admit there is actually a nice added touch to the extended television version is there is a bit before Superman flies him in where, because of Ms. Tessmacher's betrayal, you see Otis about to lower her into a pit of previously established monstrosities that are kept off screen, but we know will basically rend her limb from limb when she's put down.
As all good monstrosities should.
Yeah, and naturally, you know, Superman shows up right at the end just to save save her, and put Otis and Lex away at the end there. Hence, for anybody wondering, where did Ms. Tessmacher go at the end of Part 1? There's your explanation.
Back to Hackensack, New Jersey.
But yeah, but no, and I certainly, to a degree, agree with you on that. And again, I'd almost be curious to how this film played for audiences in terms of the Zod, Non, and Ursa stuff at the start, and where that may or may not have gone afterwards. Because I think, you know, audiences today, particularly if you're growing up with a sort of Marvel model where hints and, you know, foreshadowing for future things is, you know, part and parcel of the game. Here you have a film that I'm almost wondering whether anybody expected there would be another one. I mean, if you obviously you're paying attention to the production, that would be the case. But how many people in late 1970s Western, in America and other Western nations, were really following the production of Superman the movie so closely as to know that they were filming two films at the same time, unless you were following the trade papers? I can't imagine too
well,
many.
Yeah, it definitely stands out as, like, remarkably forward-thinking, but it also shows the level of attention that goes into this film. So when there are moments like characters that just seem flat or not very impactful, I can't help but feel like that is also a deliberate decision. I'm just trying to figure out the logic of why. But I feel like we could go back and forth on the trio of villains, and I think really it may just come down to personal taste, because we absolutely still have a tremendous amount of this movie left to talk about. Let me ask you this. We both talked about why we like Christopher Reeve's performance. What about the rest of the cast?
Well, to say this, let's start with our top, the other top billed actor in this film.
Because two actors get above the line billing. Hackman is one of them. Yeah. And?
Yep, and Marlon Brando, who, continue revelations about him being something of a scuzzy individual aside, as time has come to say, including The Last Tango in Paris set, he does good work here. I mean, yeah, I can guarantee you, and in fact, it's been pretty much revealed that Brando, you know, really just sort of, you know, phoned this one
in. Apparently he refused to memorize his dialogue, so every one of his scenes he's reading off of cue cards. I find that remarkable, considering, like, the power in his performance.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing performance for a guy who admittedly, you know, didn't want to learn the script because he was afraid it would be terrible and then he would turn down the bucket load of money they offered him.
Can't fault the reason.
But yeah, no, you can't. But I mean, yeah, no, he, again, just, you get the grandeur behind him in this sense here. Because, I mean, you know, his Jor-El is the sort of, again, he sort of transforms, you know, from being this elder to almost, again, deity-esque figure over the course of this film. And his performance nails everything it needs there that you would ever want out of. And I think it really helps, again, the fact that, you know, this is a film which, you know, sort of underscores its A game by having, you know, these sort of two major tier talents at sort of the opposite ends of the film, where you have Brando, you know, the man who made method acting in film probably one of the, you know, so desirable for so many actors to pursue. And then, you know, Gene Hackman on the other end of it, you know, bringing, you know, the star wattage of things like freaking The French Connection to this film. Like, it really gives this film legitimacy that it may not have otherwise had. And kudos to Brando for pulling it off. Even though I don't for one second buy that Christopher Reeve physically would be the result of Brando, necessarily.
Yeah, something's not adding up here.
Yeah. But what about you, Andrew? Any further things to add about Brando in this instance?
I mean, Brando, yeah, he definitely makes the most of what he's given. But again, like, it's not a small role. Like, his appearances on screen don't make up much of the film, but he casts a presence. Like, Jor-El is still felt throughout the film, and thanks to the crystal memory technology, but also just, like, his words repeatedly, like, literally echoing in Clark's mind for the rest of the film. Like, he gives a performance befitting of the fact that we're continually hearkening back to him, and on that he recuses himself well. And apparently, yeah, what was it? He got paid, like, something absurd, like $20 million to have his footage in the sequel.
It wasn't quite that much, but yeah, no, he basically was paid like $3 million for his appearance, which at the time was, I may very well have been the highest an actor had received.
Well, yeah. And again, it's just same thing with Louis Jourdan in last week's film, where it's like, I find it hard to believe that such a good performance could be done by someone with nothing but contempt for everyone around them. but, you know, there it is on the screen. And let's see, who else to go through? I'm surprised that, well, it makes sense considering with some of the heavy hitters in the cast why her name is buried down in the cast, but Margot Kidder as Lois Lane, really, like, ugh, she is incredible. I think she is everything that Lois Lane needs to be, where it's just, she's not quite screwball comedy levels, but like she has an energy about her. She's excited to be working on stories, to get the scoops, you know? But at the same time, like, she's not presented as like perfect by any means. Like, it's not that she's the domineering and strong woman that, you know, all men are threatened by. Like, there's the running gag where running through the newsroom she keeps talking about stories, and then Perry White keeps yelling the different spelling mistakes that she's made, where even at one point, yeah, it's like, rapist only has one P, and I'm like, that's not something you should be laughing at, but it's still kind of funny. And also, like, her scenes with Reeve, like, she expresses that sense of, like, absolute astonishment at the man that she's seeing. Like, she performs that so well that it's really impossible not to be pulled into that same sense of excitement. The balcony interview, them flying together, like, I'm not gonna lie, David, I got misty-eyed during this movie, too. It's just so idyllic. And it wouldn't have worked had Lois been played any different way. Even just like when he catches her and says, don't worry, I've got you. And she just turns and her voice cracks and she just shrieks, but then who's got you? Like, they are the perfect on-screen pairing of these characters.
Well, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, Kidder, I think, gets a bit of a raw deal. I mean, certainly I don't think she owns the role in quite the same way Reeves has captured the public attention. I mean, because I will say, there are other Loises that I also really enjoy, and I think it's one of those characters where there's more room for interpretation, perhaps, than, say, what we sort of consider for the Man of Steel himself. Having said that, I mean, yeah, no, Kidder really kills it in this role. She's sweet and endearing, and
She can take down a mugger perfectly well on her own.
Exactly, and there's, like, little things where even stuff that people tend to, you know, a lot of people tend to mock the poetry of the Can You Read My Mind sequence. I'm sorry, her performance of that, as, you know, as silly as a poem as it may be, she makes it work. I completely go with that sequence, and she nails it. And yeah, if she did not work in this movie, the climax of this film wouldn't work whatsoever, because you have to buy about how heartbroken Superman is in order for the actions he therefore takes to make sense. And yeah, no, I believe it 100% from what Kidder gives us.
Well, yeah, because the conclusion of this film, I mean, it's the platoon dilemma. You have two different fathers that you can obey, but you can't obey both. And yeah, in reversing time the wrong way, Clark ends up deciding that he's basically going to listen to Pa Kent, and he does it precisely because of Lois's death. And that's the moment where, like, all the threads of the film are pulled together, and he realizes, well, I've already been useless while someone very dear to me died before. I can do something different now. And even though I shouldn't interfere, what good am I if I'm not going to save people? And you're right. I think, same way with the third man, had if the performances weren't quite up to snuff, we wouldn't buy into the conflict or the significance of making that choice. But it's everything that Margot Kidder does in the role of Lois, you know, it makes it easy to see why.
No, you're absolutely right. But while we're on the Daily Planet, staff, let's throw these two together. Jackie Cooper as Perry White and Mark McClure as Jimmy Olsen. What do you think?
No strong opinions. I mean, they're fine. Again, I think it's... they're also operating as kind of stock characters. Like, Jimmy Olsen and Perry White have always been very stock characters. And again, they're rooted in, like, that 1950s newspaper man mentality. I think they're certainly fine. They don't detract from their scenes. It's hard for everybody to stand out when you have some, like, proper A-list performances going on. But, I mean, the cast has an ensemble. Like, everybody works. What about you, Dave? Anything of note to them?
Not necessarily. Like, I mean, I really like Jackie Cooper's, you know, sort of humorous take on Perry White. As, yeah, you're quite right. The sort of 1940s, 1950s, you know, concept of what a newspaper man is. As he's sort of, you know, just hustling about, yelling at everybody and trying to get the everything to get.
He's like a slightly less grouchy Ed Asner.
Yeah. And as for Mark McClure, he's so easily overshadowed. I mean, he got to play this role 5 times between the Chris Reeves films and the spinoff film Supergirl. And, you know, McClure, he's got comic chops. I think he's, you know, he's a delight in every scene he's in. He plays the sort of aw shucks quite right throughout. And the way, even just like little small bits when, you know, Perry's yelling at him to go get him something, and then he's just passing on the orders to the next person in line, just trying to, you know, get things done. It's like, there's small touches I really enjoy. Again, it's not standout work. He's not going to be the most memorable Jimmy Olsen, but he's certainly better than the Jimmy Olsen in Dawn of Justice, who takes a bullet in the head.
Oh yeah, that was something the character really needed. But I think in broad strokes, like whether you're looking at the trio of villains or the Daily Planet crew, this film is, it's a funny movie. Like, it is enjoyable, it made me laugh out loud, and I think that just speaks to the fact that in the lighter scenes, or in the heavier scenes, like, the whole cast has a really good sense of timing and chemistry with one another. And so, even though, like, Jimmy Olsen is never going to be the guy stealing the show from Superman, like, McClure, he's got that timing down pat where he plays off everybody well. He knows exactly when to show up and to interrupt the kiss at the end. You know, it, like, I honestly don't know if we should even do hits or pits, because I think I pointed out the one thing that I disliked. But yeah, it's just, again, there's something just so earnest and enjoyable about the film through and through.
No, you're absolutely right, without question. So I guess for the remaining cast members, we should probably give a little bit of attention to. We haven't really spoken about, let's see here. Is there really anything we can say about Terrence Stamp at this point? Because I feel like that's what we'd almost want to wait till, hopefully the one day we come back and do part 2.
I think
2.
You have to. I mean, he gets about 2 minutes of dialogue. Granted, it's a pretty awesome 2 minutes, but it's not substantial enough to really register as anything more than setup. But that being said, I think there's something that happens off screen that isn't quite a character, but is such a presence in this film that I can't imagine it without it. And that is John Williams' score.
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, let's put it this way. This is how good John Williams' score is. If you go back 2 episodes ago, you'll remember me, you know, ranting about the funny themes for the dopey characters who wander about. The exception to that rule is Otis's theme in this film, which John Williams makes it work because he's that good here. And this is, yeah, very much John Williams, you know, becoming the John Williams. But, I mean, the year previous to this film, he had Star Wars, he had this one out. This is John Williams becoming the John Williams we know and love, certainly. And, you know, this score is just magnificent. And it's easy to see why it's been so hard for many of the productions, even ones completely unrelated to this continuity in this series, to get away, to not evoke it. as shorthand for Superman. Yeah,
it's hard to it's hard to describe it because like it really does work on the level of affect and sensation more than anything you can easily describe. But his main theme for Superman, that listening to that piece conveys everything that I think Superman needs to. Like, it's just, there's a sense of bravura about it. There's an epic feel. You know, it's got the highs, it's got the lows. It just swells. And, like, even thinking about, like, I just want to run a marathon and do something nice for somebody. It's honestly, the main theme is one of my favorite pieces of film music that I have ever heard. But more importantly, like, as we discuss, like, there are the three different units that make up the film, and it seems the score also changes and adapts to those settings and tones as well. And that's a difficult balancing act to pull off, because it does still feel integrated. It's not like the early scenes, like, you clearly experience as, oh, well, this is John Williams doing sci-fi, and then here's John Williams doing Americana, and then here's John Williams doing, like, a modern action film. It all feels fluid, and yet it's all distinct. Like, it's an adaptive score, but the main theme, it hits exactly where it needs to.
No, absolutely. And I mean, this is, it's kind of interesting. First of all, I'll put it this way. I'm going to put this forward and say that this is the best piece of music John Williams has ever written. And I know that's saying something pretty daunting about a guy who's also written, you know, Raiders of the Lost, the themes for Raiders of the Lost Ark, who did Star Wars, who, you know, has done more work than most composers would.
There's a reason that he's one of the few film composers that mainstream audiences know by name.
Exactly. And the thing about it is this is at that stage where Williams is, because you listen to some of his earlier stuff before, you know, the sort of Spielberg meshing together. And the thing that we tend to forget about Williams is he can be a bit more experimental than I think people give him credit for, because I think so much of people now sort of associate him with these sort of big bombast of, you know, the horn sections and the drums. And here we get, you know, things like, again, the Krypton sequences. There is some sort of quiet eeriness that he plays with in those segments there that gives it this, you know, grandeur, but almost, you know, yeah, an alien quality.
Yeah, it's not like Forbidden Planet where it's entirely done on a theremin, but again, like, there's that sense of familiar yet just off enough to register that this is not our world.
Yeah,
exactly. To be able to do that sonically, that requires, like, a real, real precise degree of craft.
No, absolutely. I mean, like, the only person I could think of who would, at this point in time, who may have even had a hope of competing with what Williams was doing here would be somebody like Jerry Goldsmith, who, funny enough, would end up doing the score to Supergirl, which I like, but it's not Jerry Goldsmith's best piece of work by a long stretch of the imagination.
I don't think Supergirl was anyone's best piece of work.
That is not unfair. But yeah, it's, yeah, no, John Williams' score is just, again, it really shows the A-level quality and A-game that everybody brought to this film. And it's very telling that, you know, after so many years, this is still one of the most hummable pieces of superhero themes that we've ever had. Like, I mean, again, it's not to say that there haven't been great Superman themes and scores to have come since. I mean, Shirley Walker did some great music for the animated series. As much as we've sort of hammered home on these Snyder films, I like Hans Zimmer's theme for Man of Steel quite a bit, and I think it's very telling that when Danny Elfman tried to resurrect the Elfman score, or the John Williams theme for Justice League, it felt wrong in the context of where it was popping up there. But that's part of some larger structural issues in that movie, and I'm not going to go down that. But yeah, there's a reason most productions have gone back to the theme, and with good reason.
Well, yeah, and I guess to wrap up, and I feel like we could talk twice as long as this episode is going to be, but thankfully, dear listeners, we will spare you that pleasure, at least for this week. I'm just wondering, in terms of overall thoughts, what would you say about Superman revisiting it in 2018 as an older film fan?
Again, maybe it is my own nostalgia, but this film really, as the years go by, my it goes up in my estimation time and time again, because this thing is, it works like clockwork. It is, you know, it, this feels like a, so much of superhero cinema feels like, and again, you know, it is product. And I'm not saying that as a knock against those productions, because yeah, it's what Hollywood's cranking out a lot of, and not everybody who's coming onto these things is coming it to it with, you know, the kind of love and passion I think is really evident with what Dick Donner did in this particular film. And that love and respect really carries this thing through and makes it something special. And, you know, I've hammered up home on this point repeatedly, both in the prior podcast and in this one earlier on, but it feels right that there is a film like this that I feel very comfortable to be able to share with young family. That there's something that, you know, this is, you know, the gold standard for what these films can be. Not to say saying it's, you know, my all-time favorite. I'm not necessarily saying it is a perfect film, but in terms of what it's aiming to do, what it achieves, and what it means, it's really hard to do better than Superman the movie. But what about you, Andrew?
Well, I mean, I sort of assumed rewatching it that it would be a case where really the value is understanding where kind of the archetypes, the iconography, the genre codes, the blueprint for the modern superhero film. I figured that I would go back and watch it. I would see where all these tropes come from, and that would more or less be the value of the film. And I was really surprised, because on the one hand, like, this is the film that establishes certain things like that, a Pratic main score, you know, spending about half your time doing world building as part of your origin story, issues like that. But to say that this film is just a collection of those tropes that it establishes does a tremendous disservice, because it, on the one hand, you can trace almost every modern superhero film back to this one in some way, shape, or form, and yet this film still stands out in such a contrast to everything that came after. It's, at one and the same time, it set the standard, while at the same time being its own category. And yeah, it is, it's an earnest film, it's an endearing film, and some audiences may find that corny. They may find that it's, you know, not interrogating some of the sort of the latent problematics within the story. And like, visually, you know, 10 years later, when Alan Moore starts really deconstructing superhero stories, 5 years later, actually, with Miracle Man, like, a lot of it, I feel, is kind of pulled from this film itself. But at the same time, even though I hold Miracle Man's deconstruction of superhero ideas in very high esteem, I found myself just really being blown away at how enjoyable superheroes are. Because this is a film that connects you to that sense of wonder, to that sense of being young and looking at something like Superman and just being blown away. Like, everything in this film is larger than life, and yet it's all rooted within the human. Like, this is a film that never loses sight of its emotional center. And yeah, like, I honestly figured that I would have a whole lot of snark to dump on this film, and I can't really find any. I cannot recommend this movie strongly enough.
And I would also say, just as a sort of note on that, I think one thing that's become increasingly clear is, while the deconstruction of the superhero had to happen, certainly in the 1980s in comics, I mean, it was a necessary growing pain, I think, for going forward. It's also, I think at this point, I would hope that we've all sort of come to realize, it's cheap shots as well, because, yeah, the genre is inherently, it's easy to deconstruct, it's easy to take apart.
Well, yeah, Mark Miller made an entire career of saying, hey everyone, aren't comics dumb? Please buy my comic.
Yeah, and which is funny, because if you've ever read Mark Miller's Superman Adventures comic, they're actually extremely good. That's the thing that always throws me about Mark Miller. He can actually write good superhero stories when he puts his mind to it. He just chooses not to most of the time. But yeah, no, I think it, you know, it's much more difficult to pull it off legitimately and try and pull off that genre in a way that is meaningful and with respect both to the audience and to the genre itself. And for that, yeah, pure salutes to Richard Donner and company for this one. So,
I guess that takes us to our patent-pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits. But judging from this conversation, I think we could just say hits all and pits nothing. Are there any smaller elements to celebrate or to condemn this film for that we didn't get a chance to talk about in the proper discussion?
I would say, I mentioned that, again, there are multiple cuts available of this film, and, again, credit where credit's due to the editors, including Stuart Baird on this movie. It is very telling that in the original theatrical cut, that nothing really feels like it's missing, because it is a film that's lean and mean and cut to the bone. At the same time, it all works. But then again, having said that as well, I don't think that there's a bad cut of this movie out there. Honestly, I would probably say that even though Richard Donner isn't fond of the television version that was produced without his input, I think the 3-hour cut might be the best version in terms of it's leisurely, but it doesn't feel like it's overstaying its welcome. It feels like a warm bath that you can just sort of soak into and get there. Because again, it doesn't radically change the movie. It just fleshes things out and adds additional bits of business. And, you know, again, like, why is that rocket, you know, flying sort of all over the place and moving in and about in sort of odd patterns? There's an explanation for that. Again, you don't really need it, but
it's there does, if you want it.
Exactly. And yeah, and again, it shocked me watching it through to realize how much special effects footage was deleted from the final theatrical version, because there are some expensive shots. But I imagine, you know, when they got cut, you know, crew members were likely furious along the lines of, we spent so many days setting this up. And
well, yeah.
You didn't even use
the whole climax itself, where it kind of turns into a disaster movie for 20 minutes. Just like the model work and the mat work. And, you know, this is also a film that it's entirely done using practical effects and like in-camera effects. And there's always that fear that it's going to look dated, but, like, aside from some of the blue screen footage of flight scenes, like, it looks so well integrated. It all holds up. And especially, like, I think my favorite shot in the entire film is after he saves the downed helicopter on the roof of the Daily Planet building, when he takes flight there, and there's that shot from above, and he just soars, like, they pull it off and it looks tremendous. Like I'll have to make the obvious joke. I truly believed a man could fly.
Yeah, no, and with good reason. I mean, credit where credit's due to everybody who worked on this one. But what about you, Andrew? Any hits that we haven't touched upon yet that you think are worth noting?
I think we've milked it pretty thoroughly, you know, because otherwise it's just going to rabbit hole into me spending another 20 minutes talking about how much I love crystals.
Yeah.
Any pits, though?
Not so much a pit, so much as there is one part of this movie that's always makes me... It doesn't take me out of the film. It's just always like, huh, that's an interesting performance choice. And it's the co-pilot in the plane that Superman saves on his first
night.
I'm not saying what you... Just fly. There's something out there. I'm not saying what it is, but just fly.
It's just fellas, trust me. Yeah, it's a proud graduate of the William Shatner School of Acting. He's not just a fan. He's a member. There are some of the extras, like when Superman first puts on the cape, and then the guy in the lime green Cadillac is just like, whoa, man, that's far out! Like, it doesn't hold up terribly well.
It's probably the one, you know, this is the 70s moment, and yet I kind of like it as well.
Yeah, there's just, again, that sense of earnestness kind of gives a pass for everything. Or the old policeman who's like, I keep telling you, I saw the boat. He's like, yeah. Why don't you go back to the bar and finish what you started? I would say, I mean, the big, I think the big negative for some people is just going to be their personal taste on whether or not there's an effective villain. But I think the film is also structured in a way that the real conflict doesn't need to involve the villains at all. Like talking with you, I think I've softened a bit on Lex and Co. And I mean, there's the kind of enormous omnipresent pit of, well, time doesn't work that way. You've just ripped the planet in half, and instead of saving Lois, you've killed everyone. But you know, again, it's a movie about a superhero coming to us from a distant planet. How much scrutiny are you going to hold it up to? You know, do you hate fun? Okay, then you can pick apart the ending. Until then, it's just enjoy what's on screen.
I mean, it's the thing. I think the context Donner creates for that, it works. I mean, again, if this had been a film foregrounding that no, things are following the laws of physics, as in, say, again, the Snyder films, or even Singer's Superman Returns, yeah, I'd have a bit more of an issue with it. But in this instance, no. I think when you're doing something this big and this mythic, it definitely earns that. I would say the only other pit that I can think of is Susanna York doesn't get anything to do as
Well, she gets to hold a
Superman's
baby.
mother. Yeah, I think there is a story where she did apparently ask Donner, it's like, well, what the heck am I sending him? And Donner's response was, look, when we're paying you like $3 million, then you'll have something more to
Yeah,
say,
you can
which
hold a baby at
again.
home, but they won't pay you as well.
Yeah, and it's one of these things where it's like, at the very least, due to the shenanigans involving Brando not getting paid for part two, she at least got more to do in Superman 2. So I guess that film made up for it. But yeah, so that's I would say anything
I
else?
think that about does it.
All right.
Yeah, so I guess that begs the final question, though. I mean, I put on my special cape, and under the sun, I have flown us to the city of Metropolis. The question is, Dave, where are you going to be taking us next week?
Well, I figure after this wonderful, uplifting, wholesome movie, we would jump 20 years to 1998 to take a look at a film about the 1970s, less wholesome side in, the one and only Mark Christopher film,
Oh,
54,
God.
starring Ryan Phillippe, Selma Hayek, Neve Campbell, Mike Myers, and a bunch of others. Now, we're following it from Valerie Perrine, who's in the film. We're going following Miss Tessmacher all the way here. Yeah, I am dying to see, because I actually haven't seen any version of this movie, and I am very curious to see it, because this actually kind of has a little bit of a specter in my childhood in a roundabout way. And I imagine for anybody who paid attention to film magazines as well. But that'll be for next week. So tune in and join us then. But Andrew, let's just say, people have some thoughts they want to share about, Superman from 1978. Maybe we have some Zack Snyder fans who really hate our guts and want to rip us
Wait,
apart.
there are Zack
Where can they
Snyder
contact us?
fans?
Yes, there are. So what would you say, Andrew? Where could they find
You
you?
can find me on the old Twitter machine at FilmStripper. And you, David?
Yep. You can find me as at 24 panels. I'm sure maybe if we have enraged them, maybe them and the Burlore fans can come together and truly, come after us in peace, I guess. Because, what better than having fans of Zack Snyder and Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton coming after us in one unified
Or who
horde?
knows, maybe we can be that light that shows them the clearest way forward. Probably not, but I mean, it's good to have hope. And for those of you running your Andrew's Broken Promise tracker, you can also find our website currently under construction at filmstrippod.wordpress.com. That's the one. So far, I have a basic layout. I'm going to find out how to actually run a website, and hopefully, we'll have some content, some archives, some additional materials, and show notes. Hopefully, we'll have more coming your way. Right now, I just need to get through yet another week of college. So anyone who said that higher learning was more fun than reading comic books, they were categorically wrong. But anything else you would like to throw to our dear listeners, David?
Nothing whatsoever. So until then, Andrew, what parting words do you have to offer?
Well, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you if a box full of kryptonite doesn't do it first.
Bye, folks.